From 1934 to 1968, the motion picture industry followed a code that opened with this warning: no picture shall be produced which will lower the moral standards of those who see it. Hence, the sympathy of the audience shall never be thrown to the side of crime, wrongdoing, evil, or sin. The code was enforced by the Hays Office, which acted as Hollywood's board of censors. Scripts and footage had to be submitted to the Hays Office, and in turn, the censors would write letters to the studios specifying necessary changes or deletions. Many of those letters have been reprinted in the new book, The Censorship Papers, by Gerald Gardner. He also wrote the CBS TV special, America Censored.
I've always been intrigued and enraged and amused by the fact that the most popular and the most famous movies of our time, from Gone with the Wind to Casablanca, have really passed through a sieve that has sort of protected the public against the facts of life.
Let's turn to the story of Casablanca. Now, you reprint some of the memos that the Hays Office censors sent to the filmmakers of Casablanca. And I'd like you to read one of the memos that was sent to the people making Casablanca.
You may recall in Casablanca, there is a flashback in which we see Ingrid Bergman and Humphrey Bogart in Paris, you know, in years past. And the script, written by the Epstein brothers, showed that they had gone beyond merely kissing in that scene, and the censors, which did not recognize the existence of anything beyond kissing, wrote the following memo in part, "Gentlemen, the present material seems to contain a suggestion of a sexual affair between Rick and Ilsa," those are the characters played by Bogart and Bergman, "which would be unacceptable if it came through in the finished picture. We believe this could possibly be corrected by replacing the fade-out with a dissolve and shooting the succeeding scene without any sign of a bed."
Why was the production code first established? This was when, in 1929?
Yes, it was established because there was really quite a firestorm of criticism throughout certain parts of the public, Terry, among the editorial writers, the women's clubs, the clergy, the Congress. That's quite an impressive constituency, as you can see. And they were objecting to all the sexual material that was in the motion pictures. The Hollywood movie makers were fearful that Congress would pass a law setting up a national censorship board. Congress was very close to doing that, and so they said, if Congress is going to do it, we'll do it ourselves, and we'll keep the censorship in-house. And they set up the Hays Office.
Was there a list of words specified in the code that you weren't allowed to say in a movie?
Oh, yes. Of course, obligatory words like hell and damn were forbidden. But even somewhat innocent-sounding words like madam or hot woman or nuts, or the word nuts, interestingly enough, was considered absolutely taboo. Even when in a very innocent context, Betty Davis once offered a tray of nuts to George Brent in a movie, and the censors cut it out and forced her to say almonds. So they were very careful about words that now seem quite innocent.
In the film Pal Joey, which had a score by Rodgers and Hart, at least one song had its lyrics changed by the Hays Office. You reprint the lyrics that were considered objectionable in your book, and I'm going to ask you to either recite or sing the objectionable lyrics from Bewitched, Bothered, and Bewildered.
The ones you're referring to, the original lyrics were "vexed again, perplexed again, thank God I can be oversexed again. Romance, fini, your chance, fini, those ants that invaded my pants, fini. I'll sing to him each spring to him and worship the trousers that cling to him." And in the introduction to the song, the gal sings a line called, "He's a laugh, but I love it because the laugh's on me." All of these lines were either eliminated or laundered to remove any of the wit and any of the sexual connotation.
To give us a sense of the kind of memos that filmmakers were receiving, would you read the memo on page 202 about a streetcar named Desire?
Yeah. Now, the work of Tennessee Williams was particularly vulnerable to the censors. I mean, Tennessee Williams, as you know, has always explored the the sexual, the darker side of life. He's dealt with adultery and homosexuality, promiscuity, rape. And what you're referring to on A Streetcar Named Desire, this is part of a memo that was sent by the Hayes office to Warner Brothers, the producers of the movie version of the Broadway play. Says, gentlemen, we set forth the following 3 points as representing the 3 principal problems posed by this material in A Streetcar Named Desire under the censorship code. 1, the script contains an inference of sex perversion. That's, of course, what they meant to homosexuality. This principally has reference to the character of Blanche DuBois' young husband. There seems little doubt that this young man was homosexual. 2, there seems to be an inference of a type of nymphomania with regard to the character of Blanche herself, her peculiar and neurotic attitude towards sex, and particularly to sex attraction for young boys. It has about it an erotic flavor that seems to verge on perversion of a sort. 3, the third problem has reference to the rape, which is both justified and unpunished. All sins had to be punished in the movies. I saw Streetcar Named Desire on TV, Terry, just the other night, and it was brought home to me how very carefully, how successful they were in eliminating those first 2 points. And those were elements, and mind you, that film was made well into the 50s, and though it was a very moving film with Brando and Vivien Leigh, it was not nearly as dramatic as it was when in its original form on Broadway.
In 1968, the Hayes office and the production code were replaced by the new rating system.
That's correct.
What was the reason for the Hayes office basically being shut down?
Well, there were 2 or 3 reasons, Terry, which combined to really sound the death knell for the Hayes office. One was the growing competition of television. The movies felt they had to be able to present something that you couldn't get on television, and that was often sex, and they were being impeded by the Hayes office. The second thing was foreign films were increasingly competitive with them. They were presenting much more mature themes. And, of course, the Supreme Court along the way had given motion pictures the same First Amendment rights that the press had. And in 68, the Hayes office breathed its last breath and was replaced by the rating system, which is a lot more flexible in its ways.
Does your interest in censorship relate at all to any experiences you've had with censors in your work in the entertainment world?
Well, yes, it has in a way. I must say, in producing television shows, I was constantly struck by the fact that that certain elements that seemed somewhat innocuous to me were censored by the by the standards and practices people at the networks. And censorship in films, this is not really just a nostalgic subject, Terry. Censorship is still very much with us. You know, Senator Albert Gore and his wife were in the forefront of an effort to censor rock lyrics a year or two ago. There are still libraries throughout the United States where books like The Diary of Anne Frank and the works of Arthur Miller and Mark Twain are censored. There's still censorship on television, on MTV. There's censorship in government. You know, when troops went into Grenada, the journalists were kept out for a few days. So censorship is still very much with us. And when you examine the works of, the censors throughout the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, you know, you really see just, Arthur Schlesinger said, censorship is folly in the pursuit of virtue. You just see how much folly there really was.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Gerald Gardner is the author of The Censorship Papers, Fresh Air.